This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Spike Lee tackles the Vietnam War through a modern lens in Da Five Bloods, while The Vast of Night explores a strange audio frequency in 1950s New Mexico. And yes, today we're going to be tackling, you know, a pair of films that are currently streaming and widely available in these times. So obviously, you know, these are two, quite interesting films, so we're really going to be diving into both of these. Unlike, you know, but fortunately for you guys, it won't be 2.5 hours long like our previous episode. But we're going to start with The Vast of Night, which comes from director Andrew Patterson, and this is literally the only credit I was able to find on his IMDb. There is literally nothing else. He also wrote and produced the film under a pseudonym, James Montague, and also edited the film as Junius Tully. I don't know the purpose of why he gave himself all these other names, but just based on the images of him, he looks like a crazy hipster. And I think this film is the ultimate proof of that, but that's a compliment, because this film, I have to say, and I know I haven't even given a summary of it yet, but I feel the need to say this before I even dive into that, is I don't think I've ever seen anything like this film. Like, you know, it's clearly, you know, basically I'll give you a gist of how it starts and I won't spoil anything after that. But, you know, there's this inventive opening where it starts with this shot of an old television screen. And the title of the film, The Vast of Night, pops up. And essentially they're treating it like an episode of this universe's Twilight Zone. I believe it's called Paradox Theater in this universe. And then throughout the film, we get these running fuzzy TV shots throughout. And it's just really unique approach to this story, and I've never quite seen it. But essentially, like I mentioned in the intro, it centers on, you know, we have this radio host, Everett, the younger Faye, who works at the switchboard in town, and they're sort of, you know, they, you know, have this sort of fun dynamic and friendship, and essentially they come across this strange audio frequency, and this leads to some wild things happening throughout this one night in, as I said, 1950s New Mexico. But it, you know, it starts with this, you know, really, like, first off, the film is made up of some really long takes, and I thought it was really, really impressively done. But there's this great, really dialogue-heavy intro, obviously setting the tone of the 1950s, time period that we're in, and also introducing us to these central characters of Everett, who's played by Jake Horowitz, and Faye, played by Sierra McCormick, two actors who aren't well-known sort of in any way, but they seem to have certainly burgeoning careers, at least according to IMDb. But essentially, this opening sequence, you know, it's really quick-witted dialogue back and forth. They're at this high school basketball game, and Everett's trying to, you know, helping Faye try out her new tape recorder and making sure the audio quality is good and all that. And so they're essentially going around interviewing random people, etc. And then after that, things sort of kick off with this crazy 10-minute long take with Faye at the switchboard when she starts to hear weird sounds throughout it. And that's sort of when everything kicks off. But like I said, I think the style of this film is really unique. Like I said, from that opening shot of this old TV and then essentially us entering into the story through that. And then there's, like I said, there's these running TV shots throughout. There's these weird sequences where we're cutting back and forth between, you know, normal life as it is, you know, when we typically watch a film, and then, you know, through that fuzzy TV screen, which is really an interesting choice, but I thought it really worked in setting the tone. And like I said, just sort of providing a really unique vessel to tell this story. But as you can imagine, there's a strange audio frequency. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to say that it delves, you know, you could probably guess the direction this is going in 1950s New Mexico. Obviously, it goes down, you know, sort of, you know, a bit of the UFO train, but it doesn't really, you know, fully come out and get into that stuff. Although I at least won't spoil anything for the audiences. But there's some really crazy long takes. I thought the dynamic between the two central characters of Everett and Faye, I thought it was really, really fun, you know, where Everett's a bit older and he's sort of the mentor type figure, but Faye doesn't take any crap from him, and their dynamic I thought was just really provided a nice, you know, some nice characters to follow throughout this story. But you know, I just, you know, I was blown away by this film. I had expectations for it because I believe it premiered back, you know, I know at Sundance, I know it had a screening and at other, you know, different festivals it may have screened. But I heard a lot of buzz for it. And then when I put it on, I was like, well, this is not what I expected at all, but I'm so grateful. And I think, you know, what's great about, you know, this modern time in cinema is that people are really going for it, particularly in these indie realms and on these streaming services, and really, you know, just embracing their creativity. And this is a film that certainly does that. But some really interesting stylistic decisions, some fun characters to follow. There's even some intermittent black screens at certain points for, you know, just really hit home certain moments. And I think it all really comes together to create something that was a really, really fun watch. Ryan, what do you think?
So I'm actually fairly blown away by the fact that this is Andrew Patterson's first film and that he's kind of taking on a little bit of that Robert Rodriguez pulling, you know, triple duty behind the camera. I don't know, man. This movie is just a blast from top to bottom. You know, they kind of use that 1950s style to tell a story, not necessarily about the 1950s, but a story that should have been told in the 1950s in some strange way. You mentioned how it kind of has that the framing device of it being like an episode of a Twilight Zone-esque television show. And it's just those little touches that are really fun. It has like a pulpy charm to it. And it kind of, and Andrew, I'm sorry to speak slightly ill of Stranger Things, but it takes away some of that artifice from, you know, that Stranger Things really leans into with the 80s stuff and the sci-fi elements. But I think here, obviously, being much, much lower budgeted, they had to rely more so on economy of storytelling. But really, every dollar is up there on the screen. You mentioned some of the long takes, and there was just that one. I wasn't even counting how long it was, but it basically goes through in the middle of the movie, like the entire town from the radio station and through like this high school basketball game that literally everyone who lives in the town is at. And just like incredible moments like that. The switchboard sequence is incredible. I think Sierra McCormick does such a good job of commanding attention while she's on screen for that. Jake Horowitz has some really just great rat-a-tat dialogue that he just sinks his teeth into and chews. It's just incredible how cocksure he is throughout the entire thing, too. You mentioned those moments of black. You know, Jake Horowitz's character runs this radio show, and there's a soldier who calls in and is kind of heavily implied that he's working at Area 51, and he's kind of describing some of the, you know, sci-fi elements that do pop up later. But it's just a very riveting scene because we don't get anything else. There are no cutaways, and basically, all the background noise drops out. We're really made to focus on what this guy is telling us. And that's where some of those black screens come in. And it really underscores the tension even more so. And it's really kind of hammering home the point that things are changing and things are getting very, very strange at this point. I don't know. It's just it's those little touches that it's the sum of its parts. Every single thing works in tandem. And I think that it just continues to build on that fun. And there's even another, you know, they visit an elderly woman telling more to the story late in the film that has a similar effect. And you're just like absolutely glued to the screen. It's not sensationalistic. There isn't a hell of a lot going on in terms outside of those big camera movements in terms of eye catching camera movements or anything like that. There's some great production design and costume work, but it just holds your attention. And I think that's just a credit to the actors who have that, you know, that gravity in their voice and that sincerity to sell the story. But it's really like, it's just fun. And honestly, it's, especially nowadays, it's just good to have that kind of escapism again.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly don't take offense to you invoking Stranger Things, because this is a completely different thing. This is sort of, like I said, this is a more, it feels more realistic take, whereas that's a, Stranger Things is a more heightened take, whereas this, it feels, you know, really lived in and realistic almost in its approach to these sort of paranormal type stuff. And you mentioned that sequence with the old woman. I mean, I'll be honest, like that sequence just chilled me to the bone. Like, it's a mostly unbroken shot, and we won't get into the details of it, but this is a mostly unbroken shot of the profile of this woman telling this story about her son to Everett. And it's just, and the way they use the edit in that sequence where it's like mostly unbroken, there's, you know, a cutaway or two to Everett, but it's mostly unbroken of just her telling the story. And then, you know, at the end of the sequence, when, you know, her mood changes, they shift the shot on her to a new shot. and it's like really impactful. And it's just simple things like that that just show you how in command this filmmaker Andrew Patterson is. And like this is his first film, so it's just crazy to see that type of talent and confidence on display from the get-go. And you mentioned that, you know, long swooping take that goes all across the town that literally follows that 10-minute long shot of Faye at the switchboard. So it's like, oh, we have this long 10-minute shot of her just there and acting, and this young actress, and then we're gonna have a crazy swooping long take that goes all across the town. It was just like really wild and crazy, but it doesn't feel show-offy, and it feels like completely within the realm of this film, and it feels like it makes complete sense that you would tell the story in this way to ratchet up the tension and to really, you know. And then there's, you know, people calling in to the switchboard saying there's something in the sky and stuff, and it really helps by using these unique stylistic decisions to really heighten that and really make us feel, you know, the nature of this story. And you know, I think there's some really interesting, you know, moments late in the film which we can't really get into without spoiling it. But safe to say, I thought it was a really interesting note that they decided to leave the film on. But I thought it was really interesting, and I just wanted to mention something without getting into spoilers. How the old woman, when she was telling her story, how she talks about how essentially they wait for nights like this when everyone's at this basketball game and not crazily populated areas, and then, you know, and then as soon as the game is over, they'll be gone. And that was such a chilling line, but I also thought just a really interesting, you know, way to look at, you know, sort of UFOs, you know, through that prism. And it's just a really, I don't know, I thought when she said that line, I thought sort of like, oh, everything makes sense now, whether you're a believer or not. You know, it was just sort of a really interesting take on it to really hit home, you know, what she's dealt with over her life. But yeah, I mean, I don't really have too much more to say other than, you know, like I said, I thought this film was just really a really unique experience. I think, you know, you'll probably get a good sense, you know, I'm sure, you know, I can only imagine. I didn't look too much, you know, at the reviews on Amazon, because that's where humanity goes to die. But, you know, of course, I'm sure this film is not getting high ratings because people don't know how to react to something that stands on its own and that is so unique. But I think it's safe to say that Andrew Patterson's got quite the calling card for himself after making this film. And I'm really excited to see not only what he does next, but also what these young actors like Jake Horowitz and Sierra McCormick do next, because I thought they were just perfectly cast. Like, Jake Horowitz felt like he was that character. He felt like he was straight out of the 50s, and so did McCormick. And I thought she in particular, I thought, just added a really fun energy to the film. And there's some fun, like I said, there's this fun sequence where Faye is like running to the library, and that's one of the sequences where we're cutting back and forth between how we usually view a film and then viewing her through fuzzy blue TV screens. And, you know, she steals a bike, and it's just this fun sequence, and then Everett shows up in a stolen car to pick her up, and it's just this fun little moment where these where you, like, you know, it's almost like you completely understand these characters without needing, you know, any backstory or anything of the sort, which we don't need. But yeah, I don't know, I just thought it was really fun. I thought it was a blast. I think you'll know quickly into the film whether it is for you or not, but I think it's a fun throwback, but also really unique way to tell a story. And like I said, I can't wait to see what Andrew Patterson does next.
You know, it's you mentioned the Amazon reviews, and I just want to throw it out there. If you don't follow Insane Letterboxd Reviews on Twitter, do yourself a favor and give that a shot. But getting back to The Vast of Night, it's funny because I saw a couple videos on YouTube that I think were titled The Ending of The Vast of Night Explained. And honestly, the movie's pretty straightforward. I don't think it doesn't really leave you with a sense of ambiguity. And you mentioned that whole, you know, the foreboding story from the old woman about how they'll be gone by the time everyone's out of the gym. And it's like, you know where this is going. You know what the hell is happening. Is it just that it's not, I don't understand how this wouldn't appeal to a mass audience. Maybe I'm just that out of touch. I don't know if it's because it's not sassy enough or what, if it's because of the low budget, but I don't know. This movie is just like purely entertaining. It's not super demanding, and but it is super engaging. And I think that that's all that audiences should be asking for. But I do see that it is in the on Rotten Tomatoes in the top 10 most streamed movies of the week. So it looks like people are responding well to it, at least. I don't know. I'll take it as a good sign. But yeah, I'm curious as to where Patterson goes next, if he's going to maybe give us more episodes of series within this universe, or if it's going to be if he's just going to completely shift gears altogether. And honestly, I kind of lean to I'd want to see him do the latter, although I do think you could get a bit more mileage out of the former. I don't know. It's an exclamation point of a very confident first film. And once again, it left me fuming with jealousy.
Yeah, and just as a last note, I feel like what's really interesting about this film is I was just thinking about this. I was like, I feel like it almost defies genre, like where you would place it. Because originally when people were talking about it, I was like, oh, is this going to be like a horror type thing? It isn't. Is it really a sci-fi thing? Not really. It feels like almost like a slice of life type thing. And that's a weird statement to make, but just from a really unique perspective. So I think that's like really interesting to think about and look at. And hopefully Patterson continues to defy genre conventions going forward. But yeah, I think safe to say, I think it definitely gets a recommendation from both of us. And you should definitely check it out, as we said, currently streaming on Amazon Prime. And before we get to our second film of the episode, I just briefly wanted to mention, obviously, you know, we're in a time, in the middle of summer where production seems to be starting to ramp back up in Hollywood and even overseas in some select locations. But the bigger news in this recent week was that award season has officially been pushed back, and the Oscars are going to be airing on April 25th, 2021. So that gives us, so to say, a couple extra, full months. Obviously, it makes sense that they're doing this, obviously, for obvious reasons, because although there's been a lot of great stuff out there on VOD, a lot of films have been getting pushed back. I'm really interested, maybe Ryan, you know more about this, but I'm really curious to see if there are any, eligibility changes in terms of like the time when a film has to be released. I'm going to assume not at this point, but I know there's been some other things. Like I know the Academy recently, has decided that they're going to stick to, 10 Best Picture nominees rather than making it some random number depending on how many votes each film get. But, I think it's interesting to look at, obviously in these unprecedented times, it makes sense that they're going to push back in other award shows. I know BAFTA pushed back as well, because obviously they're going to follow suit with the Oscars. It would make no sense to stand on your same date. But, obviously this gives us more time to get in, hopefully some more good stuff. But also we don't know what the film landscape is necessarily going to look at and what, the awards movies are going to be, or how many there are going to be in the first place, I guess.
So I know that the eligibility in terms of release date, obviously we've mentioned before here that it's any movie, they're foregoing the theatrical run for New York and LA, especially for a lot of the earlier in the year movies. And they're going to be taking into account streaming films that had originally intended to be theatrically released, and I think they're actually extending that until the end of February, if I'm not mistaken. And that makes sense, because you got to figure a lot of movies that were supposed to come out in November and December might end up getting pushed back a couple months or a few more weeks. And I think that's probably a good thing, because the studios were probably in the Academy's ear saying, with this movie we want to position it to run as a 2020 nominee, but it's not going to be ready before. And by that point maybe we'll have a vaccine, maybe things will finally start turning back to normal. But yeah, it's going to be fascinating. There is also a certain film directed by Steven Spielberg coming out in December that I'm curious as to what they're going to do with that release date. But that's another story for another time. How that's going to affect the Oscar landscape would be cynical of me to ask. But, it's just there's, like you said, it's uncertain times, as we hear in all the commercials. It's pure madness. But I'm glad that movies and you know what? It's at the end of the day, it's the Oscars. It doesn't matter. We can bend the rules. If a movie was supposed to get released in 2020 and it's not going to get pushed, it's not going to get out until February, what the fuck? Just let it compete.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, we certainly have that to look forward to. And like I said, you know, in unprecedented times, obviously we're going to be exploring, you know, and we're going to be still watching as many films as we possibly can. We'll see. Who knows what's going to happen with theaters. Obviously, Tenet recently got slightly pushed back, not crazily pushed back, only a couple weeks to the end of July. So I believe Mulan is sort of, you know, I don't believe Disney has pushed it off its date yet, which I believe is July 24th. So it's going to be interesting to see how many dominoes fall in regards to that and when, you know, movie theaters start to ramp up once again. But obviously, we'll be here to cover it when the stuff happens.
Yeah, I remember I thought I saw some scuttlebutt about Mulan actually just going straight to Disney Plus. I can't confirm that per se. I might have just seen it on Twitter in a, you know, high state, and I might have misread it, but I wouldn't be shocked if that happened, and that might be the domino that makes everything else collapse, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to be something, but hopefully back to, by this point next year, we're back to something resembling, you know, completely normal. Speaking of the Oscars, I wouldn't be shocked if our next film on this episode actually showed up in a couple of the categories. And it is Netflix's latest prestige pick, Spike Lee's The Five Bloods. We did Black Klansman on this podcast a couple of years ago, and we were both just really big fans of it. It's just such an entertaining movie. And obviously, given the subject matter, it's really incredible what and the fact that these movies are all like 2.5 hours long, it's incredible how much Spike Lee is able to get out of these stories and get from these situations for his characters and for society as a whole, and for what he can just do for the audience. I mean, he's a very visual filmmaker, and like when you watch a Spike Lee movie, you know you're watching a Spike Lee movie. And I think that you know, obviously there was some controversy about the fact that Netflix was stingy with the budget, especially relating to 16 millimeter photography for the flashbacks, but it's just interesting to see Spike Lee work with like a bigger production, because it's really incredible what he's able to pull off. It centers around four Vietnam vets played by Delroy Lindo, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, Isaiah Whitlock Jr. I mean, these four guys have just such good chemistry, and they all play, you know, soldiers from the Vietnam War who meet up in the present day, and they're all basically going into the jungle to look for some gold that was sent by the American Army that was originally supposed to go to Vietnamese citizens at the time during the Vietnam War. But Chadwick Boseman's character, who was the fifth blood in that little camaraderie that they had, who was really kind of like the figurehead of it. He was that that firebrand who was always like that moral and ethical beacon of light, and always getting them to question why they were fighting, and at the end of the day, they're really fighting for each other. You know, he makes a compelling argument when he sees that gold sent over by the American government, and he says that, you know, we're getting sent over. They hate us over there, so they sent us over here to die so they don't have to look at us. You know, we're putting in our part for this country. This is ours. And honestly, who the hell can blame him for that? You know, Spike Lee, obviously, he frames this movie politically right from the get-go. It opens up with newsreel footage of Muhammad Ali just talking about the absurdity of the war and why he was objecting to it. And, you know, the focus of this, like so many, you know, post-Vietnam movies about the Vietnam War, it's interesting how, like, you always find a new layer that is kind of peeled back from the trauma that surrounds that whole ordeal. And obviously the racial implications of that are very prevalent. And also what that means for a black soldier to be basically complicit in the atrocities committed by a racist country and a racist army and a racist war campaign that, you know, no one asked them to fight. The Vietnamese, I mean, communism was not spreading. They were just trying to drive out the French. I don't understand how that was so hard for the American government to understand. I have my other theories, but again, this is a film podcast, and I always go off on these tangents when we have a movie with hot button political issues on it. So I apologize. It just comes out. I can't help it. But just getting back to The Five Bloods, Spike Lee, I mean, he just does so many like little interesting things. I know that, shifting aspect ratios are kind of in vogue at the moment, and using non-traditional aspect ratios. But it's interesting the way he does it here. We get like the old timey 1.37:1 when you're in the Vietnam flashback, shot in 16 millimeter. When they're just kind of in Vietnam in the city streets in Ho Chi Minh City, we get that 2.35 CinemaScope. And then when we're in the jungle, it opens up to the full 1.85, which is almost the width of a regular standard television that you'd find in the home. So it's really just like kind of insane when you see the jungle just kind of fill up your entire screen. And I think the fact that the film is actually optimized for home viewing in a way, which is actually, I kind of appreciate that little touch that, you know, obviously when you do something like this in the theater, I'm thinking back to maybe Waves back in December, when those shifting aspect ratios, it can kind of get lost in translation when you see it in the theater. I just think it works a little bit better on just a, you know, good old fashioned big screen television. But he obviously, the basic story, you know, in addition, they're going through the jungle. They're trying to find all this old gold. Delroy Lindo's character, his son happens to be with him. And, you know, he has a very tenuous relationship with his son. Delroy Lindo's character suffers from PTSD. And I think I just got to stop right there and talk about just how good this man actually is in this movie. He just is absolutely explosive and seething and vulnerable and funny and heartbreaking and frightening all at once. It is really just an incredible balancing act. There's even and obviously, as we get further into the film, we come across these characters who are basically out there disarming mines that are still left in the minefield that were left behind by the war. So there's a really great set piece that happens about midway through the film. And there's like this look of abject panic that is on Delroy Lindo's face right before the payoff of that scene. And it's just incredible, like that little moment of tension and vulnerability that we see in him, and just how that contrasts with his persona throughout the rest of the film, and just being angry at his son for, you know, the mother died in childbirth, and he always felt like that, you know, Delroy Lindo loved his wife more than he loved his son. So there's just so much great interplay there. There are just so many balls up in the air. I haven't even touched upon the stories of the other actors and how good Clark Peters is in this movie. Clark Peters, I'm a huge fan of from The Wire and Tremé. And he worked with Spike Lee on Chi-Raq as well. But it is just, you know, he's one of those under the radar actors, unless you're a massive David Simon fan. But I'm just so glad that he got a role where he was able to just sink his teeth into it, but also have fun with it, too. I never get you get the feeling that these actors were really buying into every single moment that was on screen. And I guess the only thing that holds it back from being at the top of Spike Lee's canon for me is that the central story about how they, you know, they're going, they're searching for the gold, and you know, they come across these bomb disarmers, one of whom is actually played by Paul Walter Hauser, the other one played by Jasper Pakkanen, I believe his name is pronounced, but they played KKK members in Black Klansmen, and it's actually kind of funny to see them pop in there. Melanie Thierry is kind of like the romantic interest, I guess you could say, to Jonathan Major's character, but you know, I guess the central artifice around, you know, their plot machinations aren't as, you know, it's solid, but it doesn't always elevate itself above that. It's definitely more the interplay between the characters, the trauma that they're kind of going through, how they're expressing their PTSD in different ways, how they feel lost and set up by the American government. That's where the bread and butter of this film is, in the flashbacks when we see Chadwick Boseman's firebrand. And there are some very good action scenes and the battle scenes as well. But again, I feel like I've taken up too much time. Andrew, I'm going to turn it over to you because I could go on for another.
Yeah, for sure. You know, obviously, yeah, like I said, I agree with you. I think the strength of this film is the cast, for sure. Like, if you look at the story and you take a step back from it, like we've seen a lot of the elements of this type of story before, just not through Spike Lee's particular perspective, and we haven't had actors really just as dynamite as, you know, these actors are. Obviously, you mentioned Delroy Lindo. He's rightfully so getting massive praise all across, you know, the industry at this time, and hopefully that leads to some award season glory for him, because I mean, this is easily one of the best performances of the year, for sure. You know, he's clearly, his character Paul is still clearly living the war, you know, in his mind, still haunted by, you know, the death of their former brother, played by Chadwick Boseman, Stormin' Norman, as they call him, you know, or as they refer to him, the best damn soldier who ever lived, and their former squad leader. I think, you know, that's haunting him. Obviously, you mentioned the relationship with his son. That's also, you know, plays a role. But there's some sequences, particularly late in the film, where Delroy Lindo is like he's breaking the fourth wall, almost talking to the camera, and he's like he does this thing where, you know, he has like he repeats the same line like three times. He does it a few different times and has different lines every time, but it's like really impactful, and you really and it really hits home, you know, and helps the audience really feel his experience throughout. And I think he is definitely best in show. You mentioned, you know, Clark Peters. I thought his little subplot with, you know, he had a previous relationship with a Vietnamese working girl, for lack of a better term, you know, from his time in the war. And I thought that really added a bit of heart to his character for sure. And of course, how could I not love any film that gets Isaiah Whitlock Jr. to do his usual shit, because when you cast him, it's a requirement to have him do that. That was classic Clay Davis right there from The Wire. It's what he did all the time, and it's always great. Like I feel like it's written into his contract at this point of him to say that, and I was pleasantly surprised that they squeezed it in there. But there's also some really interesting decisions at certain points. There's that sequence where there's those isolated vocals of what's going on. There's obviously, you mentioned the aspect ratio thing that sort of very smoothly is transitioning. Also throughout, Spike Lee is constantly has these cutaways to images of historical black figures. You know, I have to mention that opening montage of historical events essentially told through the black prism. I love the little touch where on screen in the text, when they look at the moon landing, it says "da moon" and then "da White House." You know, I thought the little things like that really build out, you know, what Spike Lee is going for and really channeling his creativity through that prism. I thought that was really strong. And the thing about Spike Lee that everyone probably knows at this point, you know, he is really passionate and really strong, you know, when it comes to his culture, and I think he really, you know, hits that home on many different levels throughout this film. And what I was struck by, you know, is that, you know, it's really crazy that the film was getting released, you know, in this time frame anyway, you know, just given current world events. And it's just like so like timely, you know, and it connects to, you know, problems that are ever present in society right now. I just thought that was just like, you know, it's just crazy how that happens sometimes, you know, when a film is getting released and it just sort of, you know, really, you know, comes and gets released at the right time. And obviously it's been, you know, very highly streamed on Netflix, and I'm grateful for that. And hopefully people, you know, are getting, you know, different perspectives, and who better to get a different perspective from than Spike Lee. I mean, you mentioned that sequence with the mines. You know, I just want to call out, you mentioned Paul Walter Hauser. I'm just calling this out without any context because it was just one shot that struck me. There's a shot where he dives behind a rock that I thought was iconic. I know that's a weird statement to make, but when you see the movie, you'll understand. There's this simple shot of him diving behind a rock, and I almost lost it. I just thought it was so funny. I just couldn't help myself. But like I said, I just think, you know, the scenes, particularly late in the film with Delroy Lindo, I mean, I was just like blown away. There is a point in time where he is sort of isolated from the rest of the group, and like I said, he's talking to himself, monologuing at the camera. He gets bit by a snake at a certain point, and there's just like, it's just a tour de force. There's even sort of, he has a brief fantasy moment where he talks to, you know, Chadwick Boseman's Norm, but he's talking to him in the present. And it's just, you know, and where we really get the context of what happened with those two characters, and how Lindo just emotionally loses it. And you'd be hard pressed to find, you know, you know, audience members who, if you don't feel anything at that moment, what is wrong with you? And there's some really impactful stuff, particularly late, you know, in the film. There's this sequence that takes place at a temple. Jean Reno is in the film playing this character with this small role, but it was nice to see him pop up for sure. And yeah, you mentioned, you know, Jonathan Majors playing, you know, David, who is Paul's son, Dorlando's son. And yeah, you know, I agree, like, you know, that sort of subplot, you know, and that romantic subplot doesn't necessarily go anywhere, but it didn't necessarily bother me. I understood its purpose, you know, and it also provides, you know, Jonathan Majors sort of, you know, particularly in a scene late in the film where he gets to have some emotional catharsis and talk it out with another character, you know, in terms of his father. So I thought that, you know, I understood what where he was going with that and setting it up and really having that payoff there at the end. But yeah, I agree. Like, you know, Clark Peters, Isaiah Whitlock Jr., you know, all these actors are just really great and perfect in the role. They have a really great chemistry, and it feels like they, you know, you really feel the friendship. You really feel that, oh yes, these guys definitely fought in the war together. They have been lifelong friends forever. They all have their unique perspectives on society, on contemporary society at large. But that's what I like about the film, where it explores Vietnam, where it's almost like, you know, where we have these characters in the present day returning to Vietnam, but they almost have an experience that has some of the harrowing elements of Vietnam. I'm obviously not comparing, you know, what they go through in the film, but I think that's a clear intention on Spike Lee's part to show them they're older now. And even in some of the flashbacks, I assume it was intentional based on this photo that pops up late in the film, because in the flashbacks, obviously, all those characters are still played by these actors and they all look old. But then when we see a photo of them all together in the war late in the film, they've clearly been CGI'd to look younger. So I don't know. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I thought that was really interesting how when we cut to the flashbacks, we have Chadwick Boseman and then we have all these other older actors who were supposed to be the same age as Chadwick Boseman. But something about that, I really loved that choice, where some people might view that as take them out of it. I thought it was just like, you know, and it might have been just, you know, maybe he didn't have the finances to do anything more than that. But I thought it just worked, you know, I thought it actually worked and added layers to the story itself. But really, definitely a really, you know, great film from Spike Lee. And, you know, he's certainly a voice we need more than ever now in the film industry.
You know, it's kind of funny you mentioned that whole thing with the de-aging moment, because I was actually talking with my barber about this yesterday. So the backstory, obviously, I mentioned that Netflix was stingy with the budget with the 16 millimeter, but they were also stingy with the budget with the de-aging technology. So, yeah, the reason that all the actors ended up looking their own age in those flashbacks was just because of budgetary constraints on Netflix's end. But you know what? You mentioned that you liked it. I kind of liked it, too, because I think that those flashback scenes are more supposed to be just that. They're flashbacks and we're seeing the memories from the perspectives of these characters. And maybe they just, you know, they have such a clear image of what they look like now. They can't picture themselves back then. And when we see that photo at the end, that was what they actually looked like. I don't know. I might be, you know, trying to explain away something. But I think if you look at it from it's all subjective. If you look at it from that context, it just it makes it work a little bit better. But, you know, overall, the film, it's deeply affecting for me. Obviously, this is material that's right in my wheelhouse. I was always fascinated by the Vietnam War growing up. When, you know, everyone else in American history class was, you know, super into World War II, obviously, because that's the one where the, you know, the good guys and everything like that. And you don't really learn as much about the Vietnam War. I, you know, shamefully, I was not really fully aware of every last little piece of it until I saw Ken Burns' miniseries that came out in 2017, which I highly, highly recommend. It's not, you know, typical dry Ken Burns. It's just really entertaining and engaging and also infuriating. But even having that context of that knowledge of the actual historical events compared to what these characters are, the kind of trauma that they're actually supposed to represent. Like you said, sometimes a movie just hits at the right place in the right place at the right time. And that's certainly very true at the moment. And it's incredible stuff. It's very poignant. And you don't really get that black perspective about the Vietnam War too often. And obviously, the big three Vietnam War movies, Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter, and Platoon, those are kind of held up as like the be all end all of this little subgenre. But honestly, I think this, I mean, The Five Bloods, like I said, the main plot doesn't quite gel or, you know, rivet as well as it should at times. But I think that the emotional content of the film is right up there in, with those films. And obviously, I'll be honest, I'm not a huge fan of Deer Hunter in general, but I do think it is a great example of PTSD in a time where no one knew what the hell that actually was. And I think as, you know, more white Americans are just now starting to learn more about Black history, maybe this will, like you mentioned, open up their eyes to a new perspective about some of the other shit that was going on with the Vietnam War. I mean, it's you know, they put military recruiters in poor neighborhood high schools for a reason. And obviously this is a trend that's been going on since the draft. It's been going on probably for as long as we've had an army to, and of this size, at least. You know, it's just, it's one more little thing and a big piece of why it's really hard to be an American. And I don't think too many filmmakers can give you that feeling. And I mean, that is the most complimentary, eye-opening way possible as Spike Lee.
Yeah, for sure. And I just echo, you know, all of your thoughts there, for sure. And I agree. Like I said, you know, I think, and like you said as well, some of the plot and story points, like I said, we've seen some of these, you know, story elements before, but I think it's just, like you said, the emotional content, the cast, and just Spike Lee's, you know, ability to, you know, direct, you know, certain set pieces, I think, that really elevate the settings. And like I said, it's just really crazy that this film got released at this current moment in history. And I think it's an important film, definitely, to check out. But I also think it's a worthy piece of, you know, entertainment and a good film, you know, to boot, which, you know, of course, is what we're all always seeking out, you know, on this podcast. But I think it's safe to say, obviously, this one is streaming on Netflix, and just safe to say it gets a big recommendation from both of us as well. So without further ado, I guess we can turn our attention to our next episode. We're going to be covering some other films that are currently streaming that got released over the past couple weeks. We're going to be taking on Judd Apatow's King of Staten Island, starring Pete Davidson. And then we're going to be taking on Shirley, starring Elizabeth Moss, which is currently streaming on Hulu. So two other films that you can find out there. I know King of Staten Island, it's not under a specific platform, but I know it's available through VOD, you know, to rent in various other forms. So, you know, we're definitely looking forward to tackling those, and then we'll be tackling some other random stuff that's been coming out over the past couple months in a following episode as well.
Andrew, what is Judd Apatow?
You know, it's really interesting you bring this up, because I didn't even mention it in our last 2007 episode, but I did also rewatch Knocked Up. And here's the thing with Judd Apatow. I think the thing is, like, I think I've always found, and I feel that he's better as a producer. You know, I believe he produced Walk Hard, I believe he's...
He co-wrote
and
it.
He wrote some of it as well. And I believe he's good as a writer, like, you know, some of his producing and writing on one of my favorite shows from the past, Freaks and Geeks. You know, I feel like he's good at that. But then, you know, this is a common criticism of Judd Apatow, but it really hit home when I was rewatching Knocked Up, where he has this tendency, and it was really present if anyone saw, was it called This Is 40 or whatever the hell that movie was called, Paul Rudd? You know, where it was like, he has these really weird pop culture references that it feels like it is just a dad. Just like he watched something or is going through something, and he's like, I remember in Knocked Up when I was rewatching it, because Spider-Man 3 came out right around the same time, like they're constantly mentioning Spider-Man 3, and there's also this weird subplot with Katherine Heigl working at E, and I know I'm going off on a complete tangent here, but you know, but it's like he has these tendency, obviously, you know, everyone knows he makes movies that are way too long. He needs an editor to cut his films down, and they'd be twice as effective if he did that. You know, so I'm hoping, you know, I know I've heard from a lot of people and just seen from some of the reviews that people are saying King of Staten Island is definitely different for Judd Apatow. People are saying it's not, they wouldn't even classify it as a comedy, which is really interesting, you know, with a movie that has, you know, Pete Davidson and Bill Burr and, you know, all these people in it. So I'm really intrigued to see what he's going to explore. But, you know, Ryan, you hit the nail on the head with that question, because I could go on, and I'm sure I will next episode about Judd Apatow.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what he is either. And also, I'm really looking forward to King of Staten Island, just because it's going into different territory, but just because, and I don't even like the guy, but I'm just really compelled by a bald Bill Burr with a mustache for some reason. But I don't know. We'll work through that one over the course of this week and figure out why. But hopefully we'll have something more to say about that next week. As always, thank you so much for listening to us, and we'll see you soon.